Call the meeting of the Stanislaus County Employees Retirement Association to order. Roll call.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Maria Deanda.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Ron Martin.
Here.
Mike Lynch. Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Joan Condon.
Here.
Jeff Grover. We have a quorum.
Okay. Announcements? Any announcements?
I have a few, three things, very short. Wanted to let you know that the Siegel Company has agreed to do the actuarial audit for exactly the same price that Milliman was under contract with us for. I also wanted to announce that Maria Deanda has officially won seat two back for the next 3 years. She ran unopposed.
That helped me.
We're glad to have her back for 3 years. And we have officially kicked off the RFP process for a new custodial bank. We will keep you up to speed on that process as we go along.
Okay. Any other announcements? Seeing none. Public comment? I don't see anyone from the public here other than staff and our normal cadre of guests. So I'll skip over that portion. Consent items. We have a chance to view the consent items as listed. If so, is there a motion to approve?
I have a question about 5-2.
Pull that.
On which one?
Zapin.
Okay. So you're looking at 5-H per number 2?
You want to pull down?
Did you want to pull it, Joan?
Okay. Well, I want to ask you
talk about it.
Well, okay. I'll move to approve the consent.
Pardon me?
I said I'll move to approve the consent, then we can discuss.
I think the proper would be to approve the consent items with the exception of 5H2, which has been requested to be pulled.
Then that.
Okay.
Second.
So that being the motion, we have a motion by Maria Deanda, second by Mike O'Neill, to approve the consent items as listed with the exception of 5H2, which has been pulled on the request of Joan Clendenin. Any further discussion? All those in approval signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? So moved.
The question I had is the question I've had before, and that is there's no comment about some alternate employment with the county being offered for the person.
Danny, do you want to comment on that? Don is out.
And is that because it's not a work related?
Well, we do ask them. However, because of the specific illness,
disability,
there really is no accommodations that can be done.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Any other questions in regards to item 5H2? Seeing none, do I have a motion to accept that one remaining consent item?
I will move to approve the disability retirement for Irene Zapian.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion by Maria Deanda, second by Mike O'Neill to approve item 5H2 as listed on the consent calendar. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Okay, moving on now to item 6, correspondence.
You have a hand up?
Okay.
This is a copy of a letter that was addressed to my son a while back. Highlighted two sections on the front and back. It's an activity I don't wish to support.
Also in your agenda packet, there was a corresponding copy of a email in regards to this item. Everybody have a chance to look at that as well? Is there any discussion on this item?
Is that six?
Item six.
So just to be clear, this is with regard to the type of investment and not necessarily the expected return or anything like that within the portfolio.
My hope is, at minimum, any investments we get into or that our money is loaned and gets into is legal. There is an additional question of morality and whether or not we wish to put restrictions on what we get into. I'm concerned when we start getting into supporting this kind of loan.
So you're talking about social investing?
Well, you could call it social investing.
Well, that's how I see it.
That's fine. Okay. I don't mind the label.
I think, in my opinion, having looked at this, you know, there's one way to look at it. Yes, the interest rate is high. It's typical through industry standards to charge a high rate on loans of this type, like payday loans or immediate credit loans through street-side brick-and-mortar lending agencies. One could argue that, you know, the major banks that are out there are borrowing at near zero interest rates, are charging on auto loans. They're making probably, you know, 480 to 500 basis points on an auto loan when you take out their overhead. So one could argue if we're going to, you know, look at exorbitant rates considering what the borrowing costs are, that you know, maybe we should get out of financial instruments altogether, because that's the current environment that we're operating in. One could argue that, you know, these types of loans are providing access to liquidity for people that otherwise wouldn't get it, and the interest rate is reflective of the risk premium associated with the person that's getting the money. Again, it's an industry-wide practice with street-side brick-and-mortar loan agencies and payday loan corporations. So having said that, any further discussions beyond that? Okay. In the future, would be my wish and desire that if people have something of this nature or questions of the executive director that are of this nature that affect our asset allocation, our specific investments, that they come up in members' forum, and it allows the board, such as this item today, to discuss it, because someone else may have the same concerns or wish to comment on it. Anybody have any thoughts on that? Okay. Ben?
Well, I would agree with that they come up and maybe have a more thorough discussion. But I do have similar concerns that Gordon has. And it's just my personal prejudice that I see this kind of, the people who least can't afford it being taken advantage of. I don't know if we have any duty or regard to change that in our, but it might be something that we could discuss maybe at our retreat even or something like that, to talk about do we have any issues or responsibilities around how we're invested.
A lot of pension plans up and down the state have had a conversation about social investing, and I know that issue has never been brought up since I started working here, and if that is something that you would like to talk about, we can surely accommodate that.
I'm not even sure what we're talking about here.
Yeah,
we don't do any of this stuff. This is some tribal, I mean, I'm
within Medley's organization. Yeah.
Unfortunately, if you look at item number six, the issue was concerned because we are doing this.
No, we're not. We're doing commercial. Totally different. These are to individuals.
Well, Oh, he's talking about Medley.
Medley does.
Medley has invested in this.
Well, they may be invested in that.
No, they are, and that's why it came up.
The whole point is that we're not investing in those.
Yes, we are.
Not directly, indirectly we are.
We're in their commercial loans.
One of Medley's loans is to this tribal organization who turns around and loans these payday type loans out to people. So in an indirect way, we are giving them people to do this.
What I wonder is what all the money they're making off the casinos, why they need to do this.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
You're exactly right. Apparently they don't have a casino.
At 350% interest, they don't need a casino.
Yeah, right.
So we've had a we've had a request. Is there any desire on the remainder of the board to look at in our retreat the topic of social investment?
Do we know if we don't think anybody besides Medley is doing this?
It doesn't look like it. This was plain on the, as the nose in your face when you looked at the list of investments that Medley was investing. Yeah.
Mike, you came into this a little late because you were prior commitment. So did you have, this is item six,
right,
we're discussing.
Actually, Gordon and I talked about this a little bit at the Stan Zara conference. And my only problem, or my big problem with this approach, the way Gordon brought it up, is, you know, we can pick out of the hat something that we're critical of in almost any one of these people we have as investment managers, depending on your perspective and your point of view. And I think that's a legitimate issue to bring up when they're here and we look at their annual report. They're giving us their status report and we ask questions. And, you know, Jim does it all the time. You know, why are you investing in this? And those are fair, legitimate inquiries in that context. But I don't think we are in the position of telling these people what they can and cannot do and what is right or wrong. If they come to us with their report and we find that we view their investments to be beyond the pale in terms of what we have our conscience calls for, then we ought to yank it. But you know, it's a real, we're talking about a very slippery slope.
I think on the larger question of social investing, it's one of those things, and I think I brought it up like 6 years ago or something like that, and it's kind of one of those things that kind of comes and goes. It's like the flavor of the month. I mean, I think it's a legitimate concern. I think on a broader scale, we should maybe talk about it at our retreat. At least to talk about what does that mean, how it'll impact us, and going forward, what can we do with each of our investment managers? Is this something? Is it like a pie that you can carve out a piece or something? I don't know. So, but maybe some discussion on it. But since we don't have a policy at this point regarding social investment, I don't think it's an issue right now.
Perhaps when we get closer to the next asset liability study, I can ask you if you want to go down this path and we can incorporate it into that. Shall we do that?
It is a very subjective subject, though.
Yeah, no, I mean, it really is.
It's very hard to...
It really is.
Where do you draw the line?
Yeah. Yes.
And your line may be different, a lot different
exactly.
than my line.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Somebody may be against the gun manufacturers and somebody may be for them. You know,
I'm for it.
Well, you had to bring that one up.
Well, no, but people have talked
yes.
So, you know, with South Africa, when we were in college, we were going to invest in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And
well, without getting too far afield of the agenda item and what's been discussed thus far, is there any desire on the part of the board to bring this up, as previously mentioned, at our retreat for a separate item with respect to social investing? Is there a desire on the board?
I don't mind having a discussion of it.
I don't either. We have two board members that have concern about it, you know, at least, and maybe more.
Yeah.
I think we can talk about it.
Okay.
Anything that's of a special concern to more than one board member, I think it's something we can spend a few minutes on, longer if we need to.
Okay. End of item six, item seven, SIS. Paul?
Okay. I'm going to start with the quarterly report. For the first quarter of calendar year 2013, which equates to our third quarter of fiscal year 2013. And page one, as we've been seeing on the monthly reports, U.S. equity had a very strong showing during the first quarter, with the S&P 500 up 10.6%. There were still macroeconomic concerns in Europe during the first quarter with Cyprus, and one theme has been dollar strength. The euro fell and the yen fell pretty large against the U.S. dollar, as the U.S. dollar has become the least worst best currency out there. Bank of Japan, with the new government in there, followed the U.S. and the rest of the developed world by easing further, and that helped move Japanese equities up strong. I think year-to-date, before last week's decline, they were up about 45%. And emerging markets were actually down for the first quarter, down 1.6%, as growth concerns in China and a lot of the emerging market countries are commodity-based, and commodities fell during the first quarter. The big theme has been that central banks continue to practice an easy monetary policy with short-term rates close to zero in Japan, Europe, and the U.S., and that has continued to shape investor behavior of seeking yield, and two, equities have benefited from that. I think there's a lot. Margin interests are at all-time highs once again, so we see investors borrowing with margin at very low costs and putting that into the equity market. I guess it falls under the theme, where else are you going to put your money? And certainly equities have benefited, and spread products like corporate high yields and even non-agency subprime mortgages have benefited as investors look for higher yield and higher risk instruments. Page two, the fund has continued to perform well during this fiscal year, up 6.2% for the quarter, and that's 90 basis points above its policy index and a ranking of 13th percentile. Factors that helped are listed on page two and three, and that includes almost all of the active managers. Delaware was 90 bips above their benchmark, 0.3. Legato, 0.5, 80 basis points. Capital Prospects, 130 basis points. And the two non-U.S. equity managers at the top of page three, LSV on the value side up 100, and Pyramus on the growth side up 90. Both fixed income managers outperformed. Dodge and Cox up 80 and PIMCO up 40. And the one portfolio that was below its benchmark was Dodge and Cox equity, down 80 basis points. But fiscal year to date, they are still above their benchmark. And all active managers for the first three quarters of fiscal year 2013 have added value. Page four, the portfolio stood at $1.55 billion at the end of the first quarter. That other is the SEC lending piece, minus $921,000, and that has come down with the settlement of Lehman Brothers that occurred. Page five is the listing of all the assets making up the $1.55 billion, and you can see the 12th Street building is held constant at $2.77 million, and that's probably something we need to revisit on that. Page six, the performance summary. As I said, it was a good quarter. Fiscal year to date, we're up 14.2 versus 11.8 for policy, 240 basis points of alpha, and a ranking of seventh. And now going back 5 years, which includes part of the, which includes 2008, the down year, we're up 6.2 versus 5.1 and 110 basis points of alpha there. Large growth, Delaware has done well, up 240 bips for fiscal year to date, 17.1 versus 14.7. And you can see the Russell 1000 growth index for 1, 2, 3, and 5 years is ranked 39th, 29th, 30th, and 37th percentile. So it's been a hard benchmark for active managers to beat. We're just fortunate to have Delaware, who has been able to add value over that. In large value, Dodge & Cox is up 220 bips fiscal year to date, 23.6 versus 21.4. And their longer term numbers, 5 years, have added 70 basis points. Legato and Cap Prospects, particularly Cap Prospects, has added significant value over the fiscal year to date in the past year, which translates to the U.S. equity composite up 20.5% fiscal year to date versus 18.6 for the 80-20 split. Non-U.S. on page 7, as I stated, both our managers added value during the quarter and fiscal year to date. LSV up 19.7, Pyramus up 19, adding 220 and 150 bips respectively. So the composite fiscal year to date is up 19.3 versus 17.5, and value has been added for the composite going out 5 years. Fixed income, a similar story. Dodge and Cox and PIMCO have added value for fiscal year to date of 4.4 versus 2.9 for Dodge and Cox and PIMCO versus 1.7 for the aggregate, and the composite has added 240 basis points fiscal year to date. And BlackRock, the U.S. REIT passive index, has performed quite well also, up 7.1 for the quarter, and fiscal year to date, 18% for the special situations composite versus 15.5, as Raffi has now kind of dropped off of that. It should be noted that, as you know, we were kind of forced to get out of Raffi when we did, although there was heated discussion whether to do it or not, because they shut down the that product, and it has bounced back quite nicely since then. So I know it doesn't give us solace, but... page 8, 10-year number for the plan up 8.6 versus 8.3. Our 10-year number is now above our actuary assumed rate. Page 9, the quarterly performance attribution. All sectors added value. U.S. equity up 10, non-U.S. up 19, fixed income up 30. And that allocation effect of 25 basis points is how we compare with our current weightings versus our targets. As U.S. equities has outperformed in particular, we've let that run a bit, even though it's within our range, and have not rebalanced, and that's added value. Conversely, fixed income is slightly under its benchmark. So the total fund added 83 basis points for the quarter. Very nice. Page 10. In the U.S. equity markets, we can see the P/E ratio just under 19. Forward P/E ratio 14.4, that's been creeping up with the rally. And it's been the defensive sectors, actually, that have led the way this past quarter, with healthcare up 15.8, consumer staples up 14.5, and utilities up 13.5 in the most recent quarter. Page 18 on the go-to.
And yeah, that's unusual for utilities to have that kind of a jump. I mean, they were... like the most nothing investment for years. I just can't believe they're up 17%.
Yeah, they corrected last week. Huge. They were down huge with the rates making up recently. Yeah, it is a little unusual in that equity markets have been very strong, yet it's been the defensive names leading the way. In fact, technology, the one-year number for technology was negative at the end of March. So maybe there's some value there going forward. But you're right, Jim, that is unusual. But that's sort of started to correct itself recently. Page 18 is Cap Prospects, 349 holdings with their underlying managers. And page 19, they added 1.3% for the quarter, and stock selection made up 1.5% of that. So a good quarter for them. Page 20, the bottom is the quarterly blue is positive and gold or whatever color that is negative. The last three quarters, which make up fiscal year to date, have been positive, and that's a trend we'll see with a lot of our active managers. Delaware, page 21, is concentrated, 30 holdings, has a high return of equity. Page 22, they added 50 basis points. Stock selection was very strong. Their allocation effect was negative because they have a large overweight to technology, 44 versus 31% for the Russell 1000 growth. And as I just stated, for the last year, technology has been kind of flat versus the market, although their stock selection in technology has been quite good. And page 23, the bottom, the similar story. The last three quarters have been up. In fact, eight of the last nine quarters have been positive for Delaware. Page 24 is Dodge & Cox, 72 stocks. They were down 80 basis points for the quarter. Selection effect was down 2.1. Interaction effects was up 1%. Interaction effects are basically changes they made during the quarter, trading that they did in and out of names, trimming, adding, selling old names, adding new names, and that did have a positive effect to somewhat offset selection effect. Page 26, the bottom, two of the last three quarters for fiscal year to date have been positive here, and the record prior to that, this goes out 3 years, 12 quarters total, has been kind of fairly flat. Legato, page 27, the second small cap manager on the growth side, manager, 446 stocks. Page 28, they added 60 basis points for the quarter, and stock selection was at 1.4. And then the bottom of page 29, once again, two out of three quarters positive, and four out of five prior to that. So they've had a good couple of year run there with six out of eight, the last quarter's positive. I'm going to go to page 32 now, non-U.S. equity managers, LSV. This is the cheapest portfolio from a statistics and valuation basis in our account. Non-U.S. developed and emerging market portfolio, price to earnings 11.5, well below the Acquiex U.S., and price to sales below 1 and price to book at 1.5. Page 33, added 1.1% for the quarter and stock selection at 1.2. And the nice thing is that not only our non-U.S. value has performed nicely, but our growth manager, Pyramus, on page 35 has as well. You see the price earnings 15.3 for the growth manager. And page 36, a very strong quarter, at a 2.7% with stock selection at 3.6. We go to page 38, our fixed income sector. Top right, you see dollar strength with the 1 year euro, pound, and particularly yen weakening against the dollar. That dollar strength has caused non-U.S. equities. Part of the reason why they have underperformed U.S. equities, the other part is just the some of the macro events still that we refer to in Europe. The yield curve on the bottom right, yields at the end of March are in the middle, the yellow gold line up from the red line at the end of 2012. And recently, yields have really started to spike up a bit. The 10-year that today was at 2.15%, and that's kind of broken out of a range we've been in for a few months of about 150 to 205, 210. So we'll have to see if these yields that have started to spike up a bit hold. And that's affected utilities negatively recently.
Okay. I think the only reason to have utilities so you don't have to manage your portfolio and you just look at what dividend they're paying,
right,
and just buy it on that reason. But I've never seen that.
Yeah, you would suspect the price should be fairly stable and you're just clipping your dividend, but I think it's part of the investor seeking yield have been buying utility stocks and REIT stocks to a certain, you see how our REIT portfolio is performing also, that's, you know, it's been very strong.
Well, with the rise in the 10-year, how well do you think Dodge and Cox is positioned since they're in a low interest rate, short duration environment?
It should help them against the benchmark. But that said, and we'll get to this a bit when we do our fixed income study education session, the backup in yields in May are probably causing the Barclays aggregate to be a guesstimate down 2-2.5% for the month. So you can see what happens when rates spike up in the short term. It definitely has an adverse effect on one's portfolio. Well, one would expect all else being equal, Dodge and Cox would be down less because their duration's lower. Although them being in spread products, that might be affecting their portfolio negatively too.
And HP, I saw, has done well.
I didn't want to mention that.
The only thing better would be if CIMEX was up, but, you know, we don't.
It had already been up.
It hadn't been up and down, but Hewlett Packard's actually increased a bit.
It's
not bad. It used to be.
And how much of a bounce has Raffi done?
It's above where we went in.
I think you really want to know. Yeah.
The whole investment thesis was short Apple, long European value, and I know a year ago, Paul and I said driving over here, it seemed, why on earth would you be short Apple?
So is this from a theoretical perspective? Because I thought they shut down.
So they have an ETF, a retail product that tracks.
Yeah, something we wouldn't invest in.
Yeah, it has like a $150 million market cap.
So Paul, is it a good example of think long term rather than short term?
That and sometimes at the least uncomfortable moment is the time to actually buy, not think of selling.
Seems we've heard that at the board meeting before. But
I think didn't Apple go from like 700 to 400, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly, Jeff. Yeah. And now we see a lot of value managers like LSV in the U.S. buying this stock. Okay, I'll take any questions on the quarterly before we transition to the month of April.
You should do a nice job on this. I don't know if you did this yourself or not.
Well, it's always nice when you're reporting numbers like this.
But, I mean, it's just really nicely laid out. I mean,
yeah, it is. Our performance group does a good job, and it's nice and thin.
Did you want to do 7B real quick, the top 10 holdings?
Yeah, sure. Top 10 holdings for April. This was done as of May 16th, so it was done before we had that little blip last week, which after today is, I guess, is a blip. But Russell 1000 Growth, BlackRock, the index was up 3.53% as of May 16th. Apple was 434 here. That's kind of where it's at today. Next page, the 1000 Value Passive BlackRock. That index was up 3.46%, very similar to the growth. Nothing of particular to note here. Next page, Cap Prospects, U.S. Small Cap Manager. Russell 2000 Value was up 3.54% as of May 16th, again, right in line with the 1000 indices. Some movements down on a couple of their positions. Rigaud-Bellet and Gulfport, again, is listed. Delaware, the next page, showed weakness in allergen healthcare. We started to see some weaknesses in the healthcare stocks in May. Again, that was the leading sector performer in the first quarter. So a little bit of reversal from the defensive names. Utilities went down also, as we mentioned. And some of the technology stocks have started to pop up a bit after lagging. Dodge and Cox on the next page. Merck down 4.8. There's another example of a healthcare week versus the relative to the index. And Legato, next page. Strong movements in their top position, Ultimate Software, a tech company, and Portfolio Recovery Associates, another tech name, and Encore Capital Group, all up double digits. And the S&P 500 is next, up 3.3%. The big performer there has been Google, and I get that was strong again today. And then LSV and Pyramus are the last two. The non-U.S. Acquiex U.S. was up 77 bips, so It was behind the U.S. as of the 16th. Although LSV had nice positions in Sanofi, Allianz, and BT, British Tobacco, all up strong. And then lastly, Pyramus had very good performance with 8 of their 10 stocks up. So May, we saw the Japanese market go down 7% one day last week. The U.S. was down about 3% from the reversal at the top of the middle of last week, but it's kind of come back nicely. So if we can hold the next few days, we'll have another positive month in equities in May for the U.S. stocks at least. Now for April. For the U.S. Russell 3000 up 1.64%, a good month, although small caps lagged slightly. You can see year to date up 12.9% for the Russell 3 and 10 years up 8.5%. So the 10-year number has been steadily going up from the bottom of the market just 4 years ago. Non-U.S. was stronger than U.S. in April. Aquiex U.S. up 3.8%, EFI up 5.3%, emerging markets again trailing up 0.8%, and the 10-year number for the Aquiex U.S. up 10.8%, or 2.3% above the U.S. index for 10 years. Bonds were strong in April, up 1.1%, with spread products continually to do well in April, the high yield up 1.86%. And emerging market bonds up 2.8%, although, as I said, that's going to be reversed and then some in May with the backup of rates. Page one, we ended March at $1.55 billion, and we ended April at just under $1.57 billion. So another good return month. Again, we've let domestic equities at 45% kind of drift up towards the top of the range. That's helped us from an allocation standpoint, still within the boundaries. Fixed income at 34.5, slightly above the lower end of the range. And page two, we added $19 million from the prior month, $153 million from the prior year, including benefits being paid out at about $3 million per month, which translates to a 10.8% change from the prior year. Page three, everything looks fairly good from a percent versus target standpoint. And then on page four, cash, Dodge & Cox cash was high because that cash was in place to fund Raven, and that capital was called just this past week. It took a little longer than we thought, but Dodge & Cox holding that extra cash benefited them when rates were ticking up. They had less in their portfolio subject to rates ticking up. It's just more luck than anything else. And page five, our performance for the month of April. Delaware is a little bit weaker. Still the 10 months now for fiscal year to date, 21.7 for domestic equity versus 20.2 for the Russell 3000. And the active managers, particularly Capital Prospects, doing well. Fixed income, both managers doing good, particularly Dodge and Cox, up 5.17 versus 2.72 for the 10 months, adding almost 250 bips. Non-US, the two managers continue to do well in the month of April, both adding value, particularly Pyramus. And you can see the 10 months both having similar returns, adding 274 bips combined versus the index. BlackRock is strong, 6.83 for the month. Being passive there, I like being passive there. And 17% for the 10 months. And then for the month of April, the portfolio return 1.63 versus 1.76. That's the first down month I can remember in a long time, and it was only 13 bips down, so not terrible. And then you can see the 10 months up 16.1 versus 13.75 for policy. And looks like May won't be too bad, particularly on the equity side. So hopefully we can finish the fiscal year
So, Paul, on page 3, you had an underline under securities lending. Was there a special note you wanted to make on that?
What's that?
On page 3 on my handout, you had securities lending underline. Or maybe no, what page?
Oh, it's just, yeah.
On page 3, it was page...
It's been going down.
Page,
I mean, that's
2.
Good.
Yeah. Is that the adjustment for Lehman or something?
That's just the underlying portfolio, Gordon, of bonds.
It's the cumulative returns.
Right, yeah. The price is going up, yeah. And some of those, the problem asset baits continue to pay down, so that's a positive, too. Mm-hmm. And then the rolling 3 years follow that, and I'll skip that, given what we've just said already. There's no real issues there.
Okay. Item 70, update on direct lending.
As I mentioned, Raven had its first capital call last week. As you recall, we've approved a $40 million capital commitment to Raven and a $30 million to Medley. We're in the process of negotiating with White Oak with our attorneys, which I'll update in a second. Just bear with me 1 second. Raven, first capital call was May 22nd.
No handout.
It was $10,753,000. That was funded for Dodge and Cox fixed income. Medley, first capital call was a few days earlier, May 16th, of $21.3 million of the $30 million. It's a more mature fund. It's been in existence a little while longer, so it's made more investments than Raven, and therefore it called a greater amount. We funded that from Dodge & Cox equity, $3.8 million, Delaware Large Cap Growth, $10 million, and the BlackRock Russell 1000 value, $7.5 million. Delaware was at the top end of its range, and we brought that down a bit. We are, therefore, up and running with those two. We will be getting monthly statements from them, estimating performance, and keeping up on capital calls. And as far as White Oak, which is a $40 million indicated capital commitment. The management fee stated was 1.75%. We have negotiated that down to 1.5% based on our firm and our commitment to consider them for other funds with no strings attached there. Preferred return is 7.5% with a 20% performance fee. We have a call after today's meeting with the attorney Scott to go over the most recent side letter where there was just a handful of issues left, and we don't see any, I think, problems prohibiting us from bringing that to the board at the next financial meeting in, can't believe I'm saying this, June. So that's an update there. I don't think there's been any real issues between the attorneys going back and forth on White Oak. So that's an update with those three. We will continue to keep in touch with them to get a handle on next capital calls. And we are using the funding of capital calls to sort of rebalance the portfolio down towards the new target asset allocations that reduces fixed income and equities a bit. So that's an update on the direct lending.
Any further discussion on that? Okay, item 70, presentation on fixed income.
Okay, now.
You got 5 minutes. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I'm just checking. This is a very important education session, and I used as Exhibit A what rates have done in the last couple weeks here and what happens to our return of fixed income when rates spike up in a short period of time. And it's not to say this is going to continue going forward. It's hard to say. But there is a kind of consensus at some point in the future, maybe intermediate term, not short term, we'll see rates spike up like they have the last 2 weeks to higher levels. We have put together a presentation that we do not want to present in one time to you. There's a bit of material to go through. As I said, it's very important because all of our assets are with Dodge and Cox and PIMCO in kind of core plus type of Barclay aggregate type of strategies. And there are issues potentially in a rising rate environment with core fixed income in where yields are so low. And we'll go through that in the discussion. What we would propose is to do this in probably three sessions. So we're not inundating you with material, which I know can be too much, too quick, too long, and kind of break it up in three sessions. The first session today would be just kind of a refresher on the history of yields and rates and what can potentially happen. The second session would be to go over our existing fixed income portfolio, the different characteristics, what could happen to that portfolio if yields change. In our third and last session, which would be in July, would be to go over different sectors of the fixed income market that we're not invested in, potential education sessions in those areas on various firms that we would put forward, and then kind of to go through those areas and pick and choose what we want to focus on going forward. And we're not advocating drastic changes on the margin. We'd like to diversify this a little bit and to also improve yield and also improve the portfolio if and when rates do go up versus the current portfolio. The first part kind of just reiterates what Rick did last time, so I'm not even going to go over that unless there's questions. One goes, what is a bond? Two, what affects bond prices? Page two, obviously the level of interest rates. Rates rise, most bonds decline, duration, and liquidity. What affects bond prices on page three and four. And I'm going to start on page five. We'll make it real short today. What are the concerns regarding fixed income? The roles of fixed income, fixed income has been the perfect diversifier to equities. It's almost been a zero correlation between the two asset classes these past 10 or 15 years. And it's capital preservation and income generation. And in our portfolio, which has been basically a two asset class portfolio of equity and bonds, kind of a 60-40, 65-35 mix, fixed income has been the perfect diversifier to equities. But we're at a point in time where it's challenged in both of these areas. Why? Because of where rates are so low, number one, it's not generating a lot of income. And two, where yields, like we've seen the last couple of weeks, might go, capital preservation will be challenged. Page six. Yields are at near their all-time lows, and this was before they spiked up a bit. Over time, the average nominal yield has been 6.4%. That's hard to imagine. Today, they're at 1.87%. And the average real yield, when you take into account inflation, it's been 2.55%. Today, it's basically zero. So interest rates are likely to rise. The question is when. I don't know if 2 weeks ago is the answer, but you can see the chart below. There's not much more room for them to go down. Page 7, we break down rising rate and falling rate environments and what happens to corporate bonds, kind of a Dodge and Cox portfolio, and equities as measured by the U.S. S&P 500 from the 23-year period of 58 to 1981 in a rising rate environment. Corporate bonds returned 3%, inflation was 5%, so we had a real return of minus 2%. And the S&P 8.6% gave us a real return of 3.6%. In a falling rate environment, which is much more kind, corporate bonds had a 6.8% annual real return, and the S&P 500 7.7%. The question is, after 30 years of falling rates, you know, we're probably close to the end, and we might switch back to that top half, a rising rate environment. Page 8. Yields and returns. This is the current, was the, at the end of March, for U.S. Treasury, what, how many issues there were in the 2, 5, 10, 30, and TIPS, and what the yields were. And you see the 10-year was 1.87. That's the one that's 2.15 today. And what would happen if rates went 1%, if they fell 1% or rose 1%. And you can see, as you go up the maturity ladder, the effect on rising rates is fairly significant, where a long-dated 10-year would go down 9%, and a 30-year would go down 20%. That's a little bit scary when you want your bonds to be capital preservation. That's where Dodge and Cox having a lower duration will protect you a little bit. And falling, it's basically the same thing going the other direction, positive for you. Page 9, we take the same chart and we look at other type of sectors. The broad market for fixed income would be more of a Barclays aggregate type of market. MBS is mortgage-backed securities. Municipals, corporate, high yield are below investment grade corporates. Floating rate is another term for bank loans. Those tend to be corporates that have a ability to increase their rates they charge if rates go up to their borrowers. Emerging market debt in dollars and emerging market debt in local currencies. So there's a lot of different sectors. Some of them are below investment grade, others are investment grade, and you can see the broad market, a 1% impact would have a 5.3% price change going forward during that time that bonds change 1%. We've had a 30 basis points change the last month, so roughly a third of that has occurred just in the last couple weeks. So this is something we want to keep in mind when we look at various portfolios, including our own, Dodge and Cox and PIMCO. Let's do a couple more pages. Page 10, every year there's a firm, DFA, Dimensional Fund Advisors. They put out this huge book with a bunch of with data going back in time for all the major indices, equities and bonds. And here's historical bond return data for a one-month U.S. Treasury bill, a long-term government bond, long-term corporate bond by decades, starting in 1926 and ending in 2012. And you can see the average bolded in the far right column going over those 86 years, that T-bills have averaged 3.5%. What's interesting, cash generally has an average of inflation plus about 1%. Inflation today is at right around 1.8%. So cash levels should be about 2.75%, and they're basically zero. And that's the impact of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and their policies. And that is causing huge problems for pension funds. We have a page going further showing that, because a good part of your return over time has been the cash component that you've earned, which in fact, here it's 3.5%. If you look at it from like 1980 to present, it's even greater. And today you're starting with 0% as that cash part of your return. Long-term government bonds, 5.7, 2.4% above cash. Corporates, another 40 bips at 6.1. CPI has averaged 3% over those 86 years. So the inflation adjusted in government bond long term is 2.6, and corporate is another 0.5 above that. Below, we show the U.S. aggregate index. It has a shorter time period from 1980. It coincides with that falling bond yield period, and that's average 8.2%. So we should not expect that aggregate type return, obviously 8.2% going forward. That's been completely in that falling yield category, and at some point we're going to switch to that rising yield. Page 11, these are our expectations today in our capital markets. Aggregate 2.4%, you can see high yield 4.5, EM debt 4.4, cash at 1.5, that's not current cash levels, but what we expect cash to be over the next 2 to 3 market cycles or 8 to 10 years. And our new fixed income allocation is roughly 30%, and 30% of the portfolio with a 2.4% return expectation in red. That's the issue.
So are you recommending that we consider a substantial move
We're gonna look at those, Mike, but our recommendation is not to consider most of those, actually. And we'll go over why. So much money has flowed in those sectors where the yields have come down so much, we don't think it's worth the risk to a certain extent to go in a lot of those areas.
I mean, do you think we should go from 30 to 20% of the portfolio?
Not necessarily.
Aren't you talking more of a shift within the fixed income portfolio?
Yeah, we would consider, we're going to probably recommend just two things. I'll get ahead of myself. We'd like to bring back Prima, the CMBS manager who was in a few years ago, that some of you might remember. They're very conservative, investment grade, with a yield of about 6% of their portfolio today. The second thing is we'd like to talk to PIMCO about expanding their opportunity set to include some of these areas, and we can determine what areas and how much that would incrementally add yield to their portfolio. It's a real balancing act of chasing yield, reaching for yield but not overreaching is the term I use. And overreaching, particularly in these spread products that are higher risk in nature, which I've seen yields come down so much, just is not attractive today. So we want to pick our spots, is the way I would phase.
So I don't understand. 30% of the portfolio, we expect the return to be 2.4%. That means the other 70% has to make up the difference between 2.4 and 7.5 plus 7.5 on their own for us to meet our assumed rate
right
of return.
Now, that said, our portfolios of, and we show it when we go over next time, we'll go over our existing portfolios. Our yield on our existing portfolios in Dodge and Cox and PIMCO is higher than the 2.4.
But we're still putting an enormous burden on the other side.
Yes, you're exactly right. It is at our yield is 4% versus 2.4. So that is 160 bips higher than our capital markets expect. So 30% of our portfolio is expected to return 4% as it stands today. I think by incrementally looking at those two other things, we can improve that 4% to a higher level without adding on too much or undue risk. And then it's 30% at 5 plus 70% times X has to get you that. So it's hard. Like I said, with cash at where it's at, it's becomes a difficult issue.
And at some point, these equity markets are going to turn around.
Absolutely.
So we were saved last time by having 40% in fixed income.
And we are decreasing fixed income from where we were previously fairly dramatically. And 7.5% of that's going in direct lending, where we expect to have, you know, 10% net type of returns or better too. But it's
we gotta add that to the other 70% to get to 70.
Yeah.
Or else we're just like, this whole thing is just smoking.
Right.
We need a casino.
So I will that's a good stopping point. And that's the critical issue, Mike, is what you just said.
So when do you see us getting there to a 7.5?
In direct lending, or?
In any category that doesn't catch up with, because we're only getting the 4.5 on that part of the portfolio. How do we catch up?
We are at.
Or do you overall get to the 4.5?
We are at a 7% expected return with our new policy mix. Real return of 4.7, given our inflation at 2.3. So 4.7.
3.25 is.
What's that?
3.25 is our expectation. That's how we got to the 7.75.
So we're right at 7.95, 8%.
Right.
So that's how we get there.
Realize too that this, I know you're saying 2.4, but when we developed our assumption based on 7.75, that your fixed income expectation was 2.8%.
Yes.
In this, so it's not so that far outrageous here. You know, where
and like
are
I said, at. Our portfolio yield is higher than that, than our expectation. So we get there, but it's going to be challenging.
Okay, any further discussion on that? Seeing none, moving on to item 8, Executive Director.
This next item is based on a request from Maria regarding the ability to email secure agenda items. And I had staff, particularly Reed Love, take a look at some possible solutions here, and he looked at three. The first solution he came up with was the ability to add some software to your personal computers, and then you'd have to sign in and to be able to receive these emails from us. However, as he found out, it would require a lot more work on his part to be able to do something like this. The second option is something that's already available to us and is what we want to do, essentially. Through the county's SPT, we can actually, they have a website where you can be assigned a unique user ID and password and go on and receive those. They'll be.
Pardon, Citrix?
I don't think it's Citrix. It might be. You know what? Honestly, I'm not that familiar with the research he did on this. He was supposed to give this agenda item, and he's not here today, so.
Because I have Citrix through Behavioral Health.
Okay.
On my personal computer, and it's supposed to be secure.
Yeah, he did find that this is a very secure way to transmit this type of information. It's very cost effective. It won't cost us any more money. And then the third alternative that he came up with was what we discussed in November, I believe, of 2011, and using tablets. He found out, obviously, that tablets have come down dramatically in price. However, for us to be able to do this, we'd still have to go out and hire a third-party vendor to be able to administer the software that would allow us to control the information on the iPad. In other words, we'd be able to go in, and once you got it and looked at it, then we would have the ability to delete it and completely wipe it off that iPad. That's still a fairly expensive alternative. The only reason I asked him to add that to this agenda item was if we got some direction from you that this is something that we might want to take a look at. It's been a year and a half almost, but I think we're still not there yet. I haven't got a lot of feedback from the board that they're ready to do this wholesale. So what we'd like to do is item B, where we just use the county's SBT service. This doesn't require a motion or for you folks to send us down this path and do this. We would just like to go ahead and do this.
Donna and I would like it.
We would.
Does that sound okay?
Yes,
with you?
We'd be fine with that.
And that is really the direct. Obviously, CSA uses it, and more we're getting counties and other agencies that are sending information encrypted. Which is really, once you have your password and everything set up, is a really, really simple process, yeah. And it ensures the security.
It exists right now. It's reasonable, and it's very efficient right now. It's something we can just do immediately. So
we're going to
go ahead and implement
separate.
That.
Is there anything difficult or expensive?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's all I have on that item.
Okay, item 8B.
Can you put that? This is the first of our quarterly reports for value added. This won't take a long time. This is something that Mr. Grover had asked for, and so we've formalized the process. We're going to be giving you this information quarterly from now on, but we'll probably do it like Paul does. We'll just stick it in the agenda each month, and we won't spend a lot of time on it. One thing I can tell you is this thing's booting up. Delaware and Capital Prospects are extremely very good performers for our portfolio. They've done quite well over the last 4.5 years. So I know there's a lot of information on these pages, but I didn't want to split this stuff up. But this essentially shows you the value added by manager. And I want to go over each of these columns very quickly. This is the beginning portfolio value as of June 30th, 2008 for each of our managers. This is the return that we would have gotten had we invested in a passive benchmark instead of choosing to go active. As we've talked about in the past, one of the decisions that this board makes is whether to invest passively or to invest actively and allow an active manager to make decisions on our behalf. To try to earn returns above the benchmark. So had we invested passively instead of investing individually with each of these managers, this would have been the benchmark return that we would have achieved. Now given that, this alpha field here is what the managers actually earned above the benchmark. So you can see that every manager except Dodge and Cox over this 4.75-year period has added returns above the benchmark. The only manager, Dodge & Cox Large Cap Value, this would have been the only one where it would have been better to invest passively instead of going active. And then Jeff also wanted to see the net cash flows, so we put those in there. This is the money. You can see that we've taken money from each of these managers except for PIMCO that we've actually added to their portfolio. And then the sum of the three gives us the ending value of the portfolio on March 31st, 2008. Then we subtract from them the managerial fees over the same period, and we end up with the total value added. So what you can see here is that Dodge and Cox over the long run, nearly 5 years, and Pyramus have actually taken value away from Stansera after fees.
this value added as a percent of portfolio is a relative measure of the value added relative to the size of their portfolio. So it's a measure of efficiency, essentially how much money they're added for each dollar that they're investing. And so the higher the value is, obviously the greater. And you can see that CAP prospects in Delaware are very, very good. They have very high efficiency ratios, if that's what you would call it. And then this last column is a very interesting number. This is the average monthly value added over this period here. And when one has average values and they can calculate the variance associated with those average values, you can calculate a probability of any individual manager actually being able to achieve value in any one given month. And so this would be a measure of consistency. The higher that number is, if it were 100%, then the manager would be adding value each and every month. So the higher the number is, the more likely the managers are to add value on any given month. And as you can see, PIMCO, this is really good. I mean, I don't have anything relative. This is the first time I've ever done an analysis of this type. But I think for a manager to be able to add value two-thirds of the time would be considered a very high number. And then I break these same numbers out by asset class, so you can see which asset classes are adding the most value. And you can see that every asset class has added value over that 4.75-year period, with fixed income being our strongest performers relative to the benchmark. And then you can see here, on average, the StanSara portfolio over the last 4.75 years has added almost $250,000 in value above the benchmark each and every month for that period of time. And then we can also look at it just for kicks. I looked at it by style so we could see which styles are actually doing quite well. And we can see small cap has been one of our better relative performers and also one of the most efficient performers as well. And then if we go to total fee summary, this is what I affectionately call the Grover Report. This just breaks down the fees, and then it also gives those fees as a percent of the average dollars managed by that manager. So you can see the fees that we pay each manager in terms of basis points or the reduction in their total returns. Kind of get an idea of what that is. And here's the most important number here. We can see that on average, StanSara pays about 36 basis points on an annual basis for active managing. And then finally, each of our managers, we have a sheet in your agenda packet that shows the quarterly value added for that 4.75-year period. And then the graph on the left shows that quarterly value, and then the graph on the right shows the cumulative value. So the cumulative value can be looked at a little bit as a trend. If it's trending upward in the most recent quarters, then the manager is improving. If it's trending down, then vice versa. And here's another example of the growth that Delaware has added. Over the course of that period of time, they've added about $9.5 million, and they've been very consistent at it as well. So you, in your package, you have this same summary for each of our managers. And then finally, like the agenda item said on the third page, I've shown the top marginal and below average performers for this period of time. And PIMCO, CAP Prospects, Delaware, Dodge & Cox, Fixed Income, and LSV have been our best performers over this period of time. Legato and Pyramus have been marginal. Legato has struggled to keep their head above water over this period of time. One would be indifferent if you could go back 4.75 years ago and choose to invest passively or choose to invest in Legato. You knew the results that you were going to get, you'd probably be indifferent of whether you chose Legato or not. So, again, they are marginal, and they have kept their heads above water for that period of time. And then, as we all know, Dodge & Cox Equity has been an underperformer over this period of time. And, again, I won't be going through this in this much detail every quarter. We'll probably just throw you these numbers and talk about it for just a couple minutes, but we will do this every quarter from this point forward.
It should be noted we cut Dodge & Cox Equity in half.
Yes.
Starting period.
And I don't have it in this one. I hard copied Delaware, but you're absolutely right. At the beginning of this period, Dodge and Cox had a very substantial allocation to their equity portfolio, and it's decreased dramatically over the last 4 3/4 years. That's all I have. Any questions on this?
I used to have one on this capital prospect. You have all these small fund managers that they have, it's a half a dozen of them or so. And then what are we paying them on top of to manage the small fund manager?
It's all in, it's inclusive in their fees.
Is that this one here, Jim?
Yeah. I didn't see a separate category for what we paid them.
So here is, right here is the total fees we pay, managerial fees we pay Cap Prospects, this $2.01 million. And then it's broken out by each of the managers. And we have the same thing for the custodial fees. We have paid Cap Prospects 91, not them, we paid Bank of New York Mellon $91,000 for the custodial fees. But that's the attribution to Cap Prospects. And then within Cap Prospects, we've attributed to each of the managers there.
So you don't break out the main company from the fund managers then?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Capital out of their 70 basis points pays the managers.
Oh, you mean the basis point attribution, Jim?
Well, you speak in different terms than I do.
Well,
we have to, each one of these money managers is charging something, but the main parent company that oversees them charges us something too, and I wondered what that was.
Well, that's all included.
That's negotiated between them and Capital Prospects. And Capital Prospects pays each of those six managers out of the 70 basis points that we pay them.
But we don't know how much they pay them.
Right. No, we don't know. But we can
assume probably all different.
Yeah.
We can assume it's less than 70 basis points.
It's a certain portion of the
right. Make some money.
There's one thing I forgot to add, I'm sorry. This is actually quite important. We got the bill for the custodial fees for the first quarter, and I about had a heart attack when I saw it, but I forgot that what had happened, and let me explain. You can see, like in Delaware, you see how the fees actually, custodial fees, over more than doubled there from 2026 to 4988. What happened is that when we originally started negotiating with Bank of New York Mellon for the custodial fees, they had came back with an average increase of about 15% in their fees. And I went back to them and negotiated, and we got that down to 8%. The way we got it down to 8% was we were able to cut the foreign exchange booking fees in half from 70 down to 35. However, to compensate for some of that decrease, they actually tied a greater portion of their custodial fees, the fee schedule, to the performance of our portfolio. So what happened is the portfolio has done extremely well over this last quarter.
Double win.
Yeah. Their original, in their old fee schedule, they only 5% of their fees came from the success of our portfolio. Now 20% of their fees come from the success of our portfolio. So what I can tell you is that based on what we expected the custodial fee to be and what it actually turned out to be, 40% of the increase, the difference based on what we thought it would be, was due to the portfolio doing better than what we had thought. However, the other 60% of the increase was the fact that the savings we thought we were going to get from the foreign exchange booking fees being cut in half didn't materialize because our traders, Pyramus and LSV, traded 30% more than what they have in the past. So a majority of the increase relative to what we thought it would be after the renegotiating was due to the fact that the traders traded 30% more than what they had in the past, and the other 40% came from the fact that the portfolio did so well.
So how do you get control of that? Is there some way?
Well, I mean, in this, I mean, the way I look at it is we did quite well here with our portfolio. So they did well. We tied the success of our portfolio returns to their success as well. So I don't necessarily consider this a bad thing. However, like I mentioned earlier in the announcements, we are going out to RFP for a new custodial bank anyway. So this fee structure, we could relook at it again with our new prospective manager.
And we've learned our lesson in terms of how we negotiate fees.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because we don't get any rebate when the portfolio doesn't do well.
No, but yes, well, their fees will go down.
Well, it goes to zero, but...
Right, their fees will go down. So, I mean, they did well because we did well. If we don't do so well, then the fees are going to go down as well. So.
But the currency traders upped their activity.
They did, by
so
quite a bit.
So was that like a, hey, guys, look at this. Make your up your activity because we got... You've changed the formula.
Well, I don't think they're colluding like that, but that's, Mike, that is obviously a small possibility that that could be going on. I don't, you want to comment on that, Paul?
Conspiracy theory.
It's, you know, it's one quarter, too, so. But what's concerning to me has been that Pyramus X custodian fees has probably been a decent manager. And in a way, they don't look so, they look indifferent
exactly.
to the passive index because of the custodian fees associated with their non-U.S. Currency trading.
So I think this is kind of what you're referring to here, is that if you look at Pyramus here, they've added $4.2 million in alpha,
right.
but then we've spent almost $3 million in managerial fees, and this custodial fee number here is due to the high number of trades that they make
right.
that the custodian has to book. Now, we did save a lot of money. We probably saved more money on LSV and Pyramus because even though they traded 30% more, the fees were cut in half.
Right.
However, everybody else, because the Bank of New York Mellon tied the fees to the success of the portfolio, we paid more on everybody else.
But this is generally something you wouldn't discover unless you drill down like Rick did on that. Hey, you look at my reports, Pyramus is doing a great job.
Exactly.
Wait, is the 30% increase in trades unusual?
Yes. Is it usual?
Unusual.
Absolutely.
So there is.
In fact, when we analyzed this fee structure from Bank of New York Mellon several months ago, we knew what they were going to do. And we looked at what the fees would be had the portfolio earned its normal 7.75%, and we assumed that the traders would continue to trade at the rate they had been trading, and that increase came out to about 8%. Bank of New York Mellon has not had an increase in their fee structure from us for well over 10 years. So we have been paying the same fees to them for the last 10 years. So an 8% increase in the fee schedule didn't seem like an exorbitant amount from my perspective when we looked at that. And I actually didn't mind the fact that we were tying some of their fees to the success of our portfolio.
Right.
It made good sense to me. Again, they did quite well, but as well we did for the first quarter.
Rick, will you be sharing this information with the individual managers?
Well, what we had started doing and we're going to continue to do is that each time somebody comes and sits down at the end of that table, we're going to present this summary here. So you'll have this to look at as these managers are all sitting down and talking.
And they will have it as well, ahead
yes,
of time?
Yes, I've given it to both of them, the last two, well, other than the person that talked to us on the phone last.
Are they getting it ahead of time to be able to answer questions?
Yes. But again, I am extremely pleased with Delaware and Capital Prospects. They have done much better than I would imagine anybody would have guessed when they were brought on board here.
And the two fixed income managers.
Yes. I also think that something that's worth noting is that I think that this shows other, if we can remove Rafe from the picture and Invesco, I think this shows that active investing does add value, but it's really predicated on the institution being able to pick and weed out who those good managers are and which ones aren't. Because if you go back to this summary right here, you can see that the portfolio has added almost $50 million. That'll pay a lot of benefits over time.
$50 million over what period?
Over the benchmark for the last 4.75 years. Had we invested in a passive benchmark in each of these allocations here, we'd have essentially, theoretically, we'd have $50 million less in the portfolio today than what we do.
I think it also shows we're, over time, have gotten smarter with our risk budget, where we're spending our risk budget on active managers that pay off. And now we know Legato and Pyramus to a certain extent, partly because of fees, are in question. And in the past, we reduced Dodge and Cox equity like we should have. And we're also passive in certain areas where we should be. So
now, when we talk about Legato and Pyramids have trading, especially Pyramids trading a lot, it's not necessarily the case that when a manager trades a lot that they won't be able to add value, because LSV is an international manager and they do a fair amount of trading, not quite as much as Pyramids, and they've added a fairly decent amount of value over the period. You can see that they've added $4.5 million right there. So they've actually, even with their fees, they've actually done quite well.
So if Pyramids only increased their trades by 15% instead of 30%, that would have been a positive number then, probably.
If Pyramids would have, it probably would have been close to zero. Remember, this is the cumulative number over the last 4.75 years. It would have reduced that somewhat.
Well, have you asked them why they increased an unusual amount?
No, I have not.
I can tell you. The dollar's strong.
Would you like us to look into
That's
this?
That's what they would
say. I would like to know.
All right.
The game is strong.
Absolutely. Paul, can you look into that?
It
and
is
find
strong.
Why the trade is increasing?
Sure.
Yeah.
This
has been a very informative exercise for me to go through, and I hope that you take some out of this, because I learned a lot going through this exercise.
Now, looking at the information that you've discovered, going forward, we know that some of the variables that could affect our actual outcome. So would that make you look at other scenarios and what ifs going forward? If, like, what if this, what if that?
In terms of the custodial fee structure?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I can go in, I've got my spreadsheet, where I can go in and play to whatever. I can put in certain returns on our portfolio and project what the fees would be.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And if anybody wants this, they can have access to this. It's very, again, it's quite interesting.
This is really well done. Right?
Yeah.
This is a good
thing.
You guys, your staff did a good job.
I like it.
Yeah, cool.
Thank you.
Okay. Back to the value added summary.
Yes.
In the second section under asset classes, line 3, that $22,341 figure. Wouldn't you say it represents?
Which number?
Under the average value add.
Uh-huh.
Is that, that's every month?
Yes.
The total, is that the entire portfolio or part of the portfolio?
That's the entire portfolio on average adds about $250,000 each month in value added.
Okay.
Returns above what we would get had we invested passively.
But did I hear Paul say we're paying out $3 million a month?
Yes.
In benefits.
In benefits. That's the shortfall, the structural shortfall that exists right now in our cash flows, our money coming in and our money going out.
So how do we deal with that?
Well, you remember we had this discussion last year. I mean, we are at a point in time in the life cycle of this pension system where it's natural to be taking money out of the plan and using it to pay benefits. Every system gets to that point in time. In fact, most every system up and down the state is like that. This is not a young plan. So you have to expect at some point in time where, that's what you put the money aside for, that's what you invested for, to be able to take it and pay benefits.
So we're not to worry about the fact that we're paying out per month four times.
Right, right now.
Okay. We're appreciating.
Right now, in fact, Gordon asked me this several months ago. He asked me to look at how much money we would have to pay benefits. And right now, there is 14 years worth of benefit payments if we earn zero on our portfolio and employers and employees made no contributions at all. So we could still pay benefits for the next 14 years. But that's not an unusual thing, again, given the fact of where we are in the life of our pension system. Plus, PEPR will have some effect a little bit. Not just PEPR, but the fact that the county instituted Tier 2s in January 2011, that will produce less of a cash flow strain, later on down the road, but we won't start to feel that for quite some time.
Because the reduction in force?
Lower benefits.
Right. The lower benefit levels of the county.
New employees.
So that'll help somewhat as well.
Or you earn a rate above your actuary's rate.
Right.
Right. But I mean, this is when the actuary calculates his costs, he assumes that the fund's going to earn exactly what the discount rate is. So, given the fact that if the fund were to earn 7.75% each and every year, the actuary has determined that the rate that we're charging the employers and employees is enough to essentially fund all benefits until the last dollar is paid. Now, if the fund turns out in 10 years from now not to earn 7.75%, that's a problem, but the actuary will see this happening as it unfolds and then adjust the rate. And vice versa, if the fund is earning greater than our rate of return, then the actuary will adjust the rate downward. So it's a game of cat and mouse as the actuary tries to catch up with the actual experience each year and makes adjustments going on. It's almost like somebody driving a car and somebody else looking behind or looking ahead and seeing what's coming and telling the driver, you know, how to steer the car. That's essentially what's going on here. The actuary is looking at what's happened in the past and makes adjustments going forward.
Can I take it one step further and just say that kind of in a worser case scenario is if the county were to shut down, basically shut down as a hiring entity, and going forward, as the only contributions we have are returns and the county's contributions. So at some point, if our returns are less than needed, the county would have to pay for every retiree in the future until the last one's gone.
Yeah, a good example of that is evidently Oakdale Fire Protection District is once a member of this system.
Mm-hmm.
Because they asked for a cash pay. Evidently, they got out of the system about 10 years or so ago, and they asked, they were put on a payment schedule, and a few weeks ago, they asked for that payoff amount. And so we calculated what that payoff amount is. They paid the bill, and they are completely out of the system now. But you're right. They shut their system down, but they still had an unfunded liability that they were on the hook for until it was paid off.
Yes, I remember them being a little surprised about that. Because they ended up basically not so much the amount, the fact that they would really were still paying on two different plans.
Okay. Thank you, Rick. We do have one item in closed session, which will cause two members to recuse themselves. So as our typical and normal fashion, we'll take item number 13 out of order, which is members' forum. So we'll go quickly around the room. Gordon, do you have anything?
Pass.
Nothing. Fred, nothing.
No.
Joan?
No.
Ron, Jim?
I have nothing today.
Mike?
The only thing I have was, I can't remember last meeting at closed session, and you called it. Did we leave? And if we do leave, I just like it reflected in the minutes that we leave in case somebody in the future says, hey, what were you doing sitting in, you know, on that issue? I don't remember either, but.
All right.
And just so the record's clear, we're going to be discussing item 9D. And that's why the two retired members have to leave.
That's fine.
Maria, anything?
Thanks to staff, Rick, about getting back to me on the encryption of information. It helps overall, just being able to receive things, less paper. How about you?
Mike.
28.
Jamie. 28. Kelly. Rick, you have anything further? And you said it was item D as in David?
D as in David.
Okay. Well, now I'll look for a motion from the floor to go into closed session with respect to item 9 as in D and the authority section to go into closed session is listed on the agenda. So do I have a motion?
I'll make that motion.
Okay, a motion from Donna Riley. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay, a second from Ron Martin. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, as people leave, we will then move into closed session.